This is a Glass Box Media podcast.
Lauren.
Mike.
So we host a podcast for Wired called Gadget Lab.
We do.
We do.
Yes, that is correct.
Tell the good people some more about it.
Well, I think the good people should definitely tune in every week because they get to hear me roasting you.
Hey, now.
All right. No, really, what Gadget Lab is Mike and I tackling the biggest questions in the world of technology. I like to think of it as the best of Wired's journalism, but in audio form. We cover the big news of the week in techland, but we also offer our expert analyses and opinions on all things consumer tech, whether that's mobile apps, hardware, startups, cryptocurrency. Mike, what's been a recent highlight episode for you?
We did a deep dive on the group behind the massive Okta hack. Mm-hmm. We also had a great conversation about Web3 and the metaverse. What stands out for you?
Never metaverse you didn't like. I really enjoyed our recent podcast about Peloton. And recently, the legendary tech journalist Kara Swisher joined us to talk all about Elon Musk and the future of Twitter. So I guess we should tell people how they can listen to our pod.
We release a new episode of Gadget Lab every week, and you can listen and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you pod.
Thanks for tuning in to an episode of Around the Coin. Our guest today is Gabriel Musella, the CEO and co-founder of CoinRule. CoinRule has raised about $3.5 million. They went through YC. Gabriel is a veteran. He started a number of different startups, three-time fundraiser. We talked about on the show the adoption of crypto for the masses, how the user experience of current DeFi products plays a role into that adoption, crypto blockchain morphing into the traditional fintech space. We talked about his story beginning as an entrepreneur in London and managing the fully remote team, much, much more. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Gabriel and I have a lot of overlap, having both started companies in crypto and in the nightlife industry. So we shared some of that journey as well. So I bring you Gabriel Musella. All right, Gabriel, I'm excited to chat with you. So most recently, you're working on CoinRule. You've seen a decent amount of success so far. Can you explain to me what, in your words, CoinRule started off attempting to do in the world? What's the initial foray or problem you're trying to solve?
Yes. Yeah, so the initial problem is to allow normal people to create automated trading strategies. So, you know, if you have a day job and you cannot sit all day long in front of charts doing fundamental analysis and all of that, you know, you can, and you want to build a machine, but you're not a good coder or you're not a tech guy, then you need to find some good tools to allow you to create these automatic rules. And that's why we came up, you know, with CoinRule in the first place. I actually wanted myself to create something like that. It was in 2016. Yeah, I bought Bitcoin in 2012, and then I sold them on Coinbase for 5% profit. I was so happy. But then, I went to Bahamas to, you know, for a holiday with a friend. It was an amazing holiday, but very expensive one. And then I still this account on Coinbase, right? So I went back 4 years after in 2016, and then I checked there was this new coin called Ethereum, and I started buying it. And then I got again into, like, you know, into the gist of cryptos. And that's where I actually wanted to create an automated strategy. I couldn't find any tool. And that's when I started sketching the first interface of our product, and then it became a company.
Yeah. And has this become a swell or, you know, in venture, I often see, like, my last company was an example of this, where one company raises 5 million or 15 million or something, and then two, three other companies quickly pop up and get funded. Is that the space now? Would you categorize it as like a hot space, or is it just an anomaly with you guys coming out?
No, it is a hot space. Yeah, there's like, we have two main competitors, but also it's very interesting. We see the ecosystem just growing in a lot of different, you know, directions, not just automated trading, but also, like, you know, someone is targeting the retailers, and I mean, someone is targeting the more like the B2B, the small family offices, the pro users. So there's a lot of diversity at the moment. And, you know, with the crypto, it's very funny because when you have a bull market, a lot of companies, random companies pop up and they are not really solid, right? But then the one that really succeed are the one that were working during the bear market. And I think when there's a low market, it's a very good opportunity for all the companies just to, you know, put heads down and actually work on the actual important thing, the product market fit, so that when next wave happens, you're ready actually to then take advantage of the product market fit that you found, and there's a huge leverage. So last time, like, you know, we grew like 10x from November 2020 to May 2021, we grew like 10x in revenues quickly in 6 months. So that's because we had done a good prep work before. So I think there are always competitors, and the market is hot always, but it also depends what competitors and how serious they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of it as when you're riding a wave, there's a huge advantage. You know, if you have an idea and it gets funded, that's great, even if there's a little product market fit. But oftentimes I look at competitors as a signal to the concept being valid and the concept being a big, big idea. So I really like the interface. It's like very intuitive, even for simple users, but it also feels like it's super powerful for people who are professional traders. How about like fast forward to the end stage of the product? Do you think of conceptually the user experience being something that is going to forever remain manual interface, or do you view trading conceptually as something that eventually just becomes, you know, 90% algorithmically determined? Like, I guess your perceptions on algorithmic trading or manual trading, period. Is this a stopgap until there's just 95% or 100% algorithms determining trades?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, in the world, if you see every industry, every product lines, you know, there's artificial intelligence and machine learning coming over, and a kind of automatization all over us. You see that with the cars, self-driving cars. You see that with the thermostats at home, with your boiler. You see it in like all different parts of life. So obviously, our assumption is that in the future, the only way to trade will be with some sort of automation that can be, you know, basically some sort of machine learning about your data and giving you prediction and giving you some sort of superpower. So so that you can take better decisions. And that's our assumption, and that's why we want to really be in that space where if you think about automation, the no-brainer will be to go on CoinRule, because you can find all sort of digital assets. And we're talking about, you know, cryptocurrencies, but as well non-crypto. In fact, we are now integrating also a stock exchange, the first one we are trialing. And then we're also looking at FX, commodities, and potentially also DeFi. We already have a proof of concept on Solana. So the idea is that you have this layer of automation to manage your portfolio, and you can trade on different exchanges on all different assets. So that would be the place where you come, you know, if you want to really compete in the market, because there's a huge disparity, right? There's investment banks, big whales, hedge funds using quant trading already. They've been using for the last 40 years. And the normal people, the hobbyist traders, they don't have access to those tools because it's just too difficult to create an algo trades. In fact, we tend to call it automated trading, because algos, they look very scary, even if an algo is actually a very simple concept, right? And that's our assumption. So we just want to give the weapon to the people so they can fight back in this kind of financial war.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I think at the end of the day, people will always make human decisions on where they put their money and their resources. And so if you give people tools to make their own decisions more sophisticated or more nuanced, then that conceptually doesn't seem like it's ever going to go away.
And also there's this thing that we truly try to respect our users as much as possible, thinking like, you know, people, you know, most of the people, they actually understand all the basic concept of finance if you explain them in the right way, in a clear way, in plain English, right? So for example, in our app, a simple stop loss, you know, it's not even called stop loss. You know, it's like we really use plain English for all sort of kind of models and strategies that you can use. And we have seen that also with the big traders or the small family offices that they trade with us. They just use like, they do accumulation. So they accumulate small amount of specific coins every day. They do liquidation so that they don't change the price, but they do it like bit by bit. They do rebalancing. They do very simple things. You know, it's not really rocket science. Everyone has a brain and they can just understand, you know, how to manage their finances. This is our main assumption. We give automation a very powerful but simple to use machine to people that have a brain and they can spend a few hours to understand how to manage their finances. This is what we do.
People with a brain. I don't know. You know, it's funny. I was looking into your background. We have a lot of overlapping experiences that I'm curious to hear your side with going into the clubbing, building like an e-commerce clubbing tool, I know you were
hairdressing.
Flared, Paylinko, all those. I had a similar experience in building a point of sale payments company. It was the first startup, raised a little bit of money and sold it. And then I built an app that allowed people to place orders for drinks in bars.
Oh.
Yeah, called FlowTab. And we were all over San Francisco. We had 12 bars up there. And that did not end up working out. But through those experiences, I'm curious to ask you, when you jump into a new concept or a new industry entirely, do you tend to hit the ground and learn as much as you can and just read everything and talk to people and absorb? Or are you more of the personality type to just execute from day one and figure it out along the way? Because I tend to be in the former category where I'm like, I feel more comfortable if I understand how things sort of work first before building.
I mean, I would love to say the first one, but actually I'm also like you, I just jump into it and then I learn, I'm kind of learning by doing type of guy. I need to actually work on a project to be able to kind of absorb all the knowledge. So I think, yeah, it's always been like kind of one company morphing into another, one idea coming up for a specific conversation, a specific situation. For example, the type of Groupon, mobile Groupon app, you know, for buying drinks and clubbing, that came because I had a very strong friendship with one guy that was at Groupon at the time. And you know, we had a lot of conversation about that. That was an economy that was growing. And then the other one about, the addressing the beauty space, that was because, my family, they are hairdressers. So I know the space very well. And there's a problem that I feel. And from that, it morphed out into Paylinko, because then it's actually also what happened to PayPal. You know, PayPal, at the beginning, they built this huge dashboard for financial transactions, but then they saw the actual one feature was working very well. It was the link with the kind of the virtual currencies account back then. And with the Flare was the same with this hairdressing company. Was basically only the PayPal link was the thing that really was working, because it turns out that mobile hairdressers, they waste a lot of time sitting around cafes just waiting for the next client. And also because the cancellation rates is very high. So we found that actually sending that simple link to get to actually collect a deposit for the booking was actually the most valuable thing for them. And that's how then we saw actually that could become a product also for other verticals, all the contractor installers, all the freelancers. And that's how Paylinko basically was born. It's always a pivot of the market, I would say. So it's kind of the company always morphs into each other. And that's usually the case, with the startups, right? It's never like something very clear and cut.
Yeah. Do you have a particular aspect of starting a business that inspires you when you jump into multiple areas? One thing I've thought about more recently as I've gotten older is what matters to me? Like, does the type of people and the type of problem matter to me? Does making money matter to me? Does just like broadly helping the world in whatever area matter? How do you think about this? Like, is it obviously crypto has the advantage that it's growing quickly, but
yeah, I think it's like a mix of feelings. So it starts always that I discover something personally, and then I get super excited. Mm. And then I start going around to understand if I just at the moment the only one discovering that, or actually someone else did it before me. And then it becomes all like kind of a kind of negotiation process. Am I in love with just the idea? There is actually a real market. So, and in the meanwhile, I keep working on, crunching the numbers, the financials, the market, kind of validate more and more and more the problem from a user research point of view. So talking to a lot of stakeholders, like, doing focus group, talking to people, one-to-one interviews. At the same time with the market, right? And it's all that negotiation that kind of then brings you back to reality. But the beginning is always a big excitement because you discover something. And it can be, in this case with the coin rule, was a personal problem. So I was super happy just to solve it for myself. And I still have the sketch of my first interface somewhere, and I will make it an NFT at some point because it's so cool, actually, the first one. And then across all this journey, then I start to also understand all the feasibility and understanding also if there is what I call founder market fit. Because, the founder really need to love the market, that sector, to be, sticking around for 10 years. So this is something that, for example, with my company Flare, the hairdressing one, I don't think I had that good fit for that specific market. That's more kind of organic and more operational. So I think I'm more like on the exponential side, more on the tech side.
Mm. So when you assess that with Coin Rule, did you feel that you had a background or a particular interest in trading, or do you look at it more broadly as in crypto is the thing that you feel you could be in for 10 years?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of crypto and kind of personal finance, kind of feeling like, I know I'm helping people to manage their finances in a better way. And also, I mean, I've been in fintech for the last 10 years, always working for a few banks in the innovation labs. So that was always the thing, how we make specific financial product more accessible, that being mobile app for mortgages or like a credit card for kids, you know, to help parents managing the finances of the kids. So all this conversation were already kind of my bread and butter for the last for the previous 10 years. And then when crypto came, it was just wow, it was just like overwhelmed. It was another level of you know, creating new world. Even if sometimes I speak with my colleagues in the crypto space and they just they decomposed on finance to kind of the primordial blocks, but then they decompose it again and they create like, you know, a saving account again. They create like, again, an IBAN code. You know what I mean? They create something that's very similar to what it was before, because at the end of the day, maybe that was the main need. That's still the main need, the fact of having a number that where people kind of send you funds, right? So some stuff are kind of in the crypto space excite me because they're very innovative, and you know, all the modularity, the concept that everything is connected to each other, and you can really foster the modular innovation by combining few things. And but the other things are also like the concept of personal finance, help like normal people to compete at the same level. I think that's a really noble mission to have.
Mm. And what exactly were you doing when you had the concept for CoinRule? Where were you working?
I was working actually in the government, in the UK government. I was a contractor for the Department for International Trade in the British government here. And actually, the idea of CoinRule came first because I was at kind of Christmas drinks. And one of my colleagues did the one strategy that every day he was just buying the top stock of the day for 24 hours and then selling it. And then he wrote a script, right, on IG Index. So I went back home that night, half drunk, trying to do the same thing on IG Index. I didn't manage to do it. I don't know, because even I'm a bad coder, I was drunk. I don't know, but the idea came about then. So it was from that night. So at the Department for International Trade, I was doing literally user experience design, user research. This was very interesting, but it was a bit unrelated from fintech.
And that was a governmental tool. So this was a public access interface that you're making when you're working for the government?
It was the portal called great.co.uk. It's for helping SMEs exporting abroad. So, you know, they have a lot of international contractors, you know, to tackle also several markets, you know, inside Europe, East Europe, and all of that. So it was interesting because I was interviewing a lot of owners of SMEs all over the countries and you know, kind of sending their problem, how the government can help them with the more services. So it was more on the service design side.
Yeah. And how long was it between when you had this concept in your head to when you knew? How long did you know your co-founders beforehand, or did you meet them fairly soon?
That's an interesting story, because at that time, I mean, I had this idea, but at that time I was already working with my previous one. I was working at Pelinko, right? At night, basically. I was doing 9 to 5 and then 5 to 11. So, and I was in this accelerator called Mass Challenge that is in Boston, but they had a couple of editions in the UK. So I was very stressed. I was working all day and then going back to Tobacco Docks in London, where I was employing 3 people actually to develop all the app, Pelinko. And then, so I was super stressed. There was always this ginger guy on the other side of the table that was like, always wanted to have a coffee with me. He was like, hey man, we should get a coffee. I was like, yeah, but I don't have time. I'm super stressed. And then after 2 months, he was really perseverant. So after 2 months, finally, we actually got to talk together. And Pelinko, my company, was going nowhere. I mean, we had a problem with the tech, the back end, all the regulation. We just started talking, and we fell in love about the idea, about the crypto space. Like, you know, there was very, there's a lot of chemistry. So we basically, slowly, we kind of decided to, after a couple of months, decided to close our current companies. And then we started CoinRule together. And then after that, it's an interesting part happened, because we had to find a co-founder. And by the way, in the same period, the co-founder I had with my Pelinko business, she got deported back to the US. She got a letter from the government. It's like, look, your visa expires in 2 weeks. You have to go back. So I lost my previous co-founder in Pelinko also, because she went away. you know, startup life is crazy. All sorts of things happen. And even then we end up finding a CTO. The first one was, we didn't get along. The second one was also we didn't get along because it was another side of the world. And then we found Zenek that was also at Mass Challenge with another company. And what happened to him, his co-founder died. This poor guy died. He discovered like leukemia. And then after 5 days died.
So, wow.
Like, man, startup life is crazy. Man,
wait, that's not startup life. That's just life. So he, wait, 5 days after discovering he died?
That's life. And so, you know, like Zenek was in shock for like, you know, a month. Then when he was getting better, he went for a trip with his sister and all of that. And then actually after the trip was, are you guys still looking for a CTO? You know, it's like, yeah, I'll join because I guys know you. We were at the accelerator together. And man, that was the best thing that happened to us because finally we had like a very strong third co-founder, CTO, and then when stuff picked up.
And how did you two split responsibilities? You mentioned you're interested in finance or market side. Like, how do you two split?
I mean, I focus more on the product side and more on the kind of sales. I'm very good at kind of emotional selling, and where my co-founder is great at all the financials, analytics, you know, the details, the numbers. He worked at Citibank, so he knows all that aspect, also how to talk to bankers. So yeah, we split like this. Like, I do more the aggressive sales and product, and then he does mostly kind of the more sophisticated marketing, the analytics, the finance as well. But we really overlap a lot. So we actually have a file where we actually, it's called co-founder responsibilities, where we actually update time to time what you're doing, what I'm doing, what are you leading, what I'm leading. It's very important because if you overlap too much, then the whole team end up having two CEOs, and they lose, you know, they don't know who to follow. So it's very good to have at least one that everyone knows, you know, that has the last word on something.
Totally. And when you're selling, are you selling now to corporations? Is it private sales? What does sales look like today?
I mean, for me, mostly was fundraising till like 6 months ago. You know, when we did a fundraise, so I was like, you know, fundraising, going on stage, boom, boom. But then now it looks more like talking to big traders, groups of traders, also talking to funds and kind of doing more enterprise packages for them. So, you know, it'll be a little bit more negotiating and aggressive on the pricing. It's a different game, you know, from the retail market. So, I do most of that. And also, I love growth hacking. I really love growth hacking. I just have so much pleasure from finding like new ways of kind of, you know, reaching a new channel, reaching a new distribution. And that's how also the lack of CoinRule was when we built this machine. It's the big growth hack that brought the first $10,000 a month in CoinRule. And it's basically, we call it the landing jam. It's a machine that builds thousands of landing pages in 7 different languages every month, and they go on Google. And it's kind of, we build this stuff systematically. It's like a machine that does all of that. And then we figured out that some of the pages, they rank first position on the first page of Google. Like, so in terms of SEO, it's really the big deal, really. So with this trick that costed us zero, but it was 3 months of work going left and right, talking to a lot of different specialists, we managed to actually get the first revenues. And now it's still like that trick still constitutes around 50% of our revenues. And it's you know, we kind of also improved it. And even some companies asked us time to time to sell them the service to them. But obviously we are focused on CoinRule.
Yeah. Let me ask you a little bit more about that. So technically speaking, you're creating extensions. So like coinrule.com/landing page A, or I'm sure there's more, you'd have naming associated with that. But
yeah, there's a component of the URL being in a specific structure in a specific way. But, you know, we capture words from in the URL with the keywords, exchanges, and all these content get mixed up. And every spread, we kind of release 16,000 pages. And we know that at least 40% of them are original. So Google loves it. Google, all these pages that are original content. The other ones, they kind of share some degree of similarities. So some of them get they don't really get crawled. That's because Google doesn't penalize you. They just don't get crawled. So you don't get traffic. But, you know, if you think about, I don't know, 10,000 pages on Google every month, even if you get one visit per page, it's a very long tail, you actually get a good stream of traffic. And then, thanks to this hack, this hack really kind of saved us from bankruptcy during COVID. Because what happened is, like, fast forward, we are in March 2020, we had a term sheet from an investor for starting our seed round. The investor all of a sudden said, like, look, guys, we have to actually keep funding our portfolio company, so the deal is not on the table anymore. We're like, oh, shit, we don't have cash flow. We don't have cash in the bank. So we had to fire a couple of people, some people in furlough. So it was pretty tough. But then I was in a position, okay, what do you have in the company now? You know, we are not going to pay salaries for us for 3 months, 6 months, that's fine. But we have a lot of traffic on the page. We need to monetize this traffic and do something with it. So we created an investment page, like literally invest in us. And then after a few days, I figured out that was illegal. So I had to actually change all the terminology and all this crap, because you cannot advertise an investment without being regulated. And then we changed it. But then it was amazing. Like we see it like unfolded, like we saw it like unfolding, like it was amazing. So we got a lot of people just like filling the form. Because they were interested in investing in the company, not in cryptos. So we got more than 120 people interested in investing several type of tickets, you know, from 10K to 100K. And then we were sending them the timesheet directly. And then with all this like pre preparation work, we went on Seeders and we did a crowdfunding campaign. And the crowdfunding campaign was just exceptional. It was like a success.
Where did you do the crowdfunding campaign?
It's called, on a platform called Seeders, but it was in the UK. Yeah, Seeders. And I mean, it was just amazing. So we were in a pre-sale, you know, there's the pre-sale before you open to the public. We already reached 100%. So we had to open and we went out to the public. We already 102% funded. So we reached, so we did a 700K USD raise. And then 1 month after the bull market started, and then when we grew 10X. So it was just like a lot of different things. And that's thanks to the landing page growth hack, to the second growth hack that was an idea that we had. You know, really, growth hacking, it's really the key to startup growth.
Yeah. So curious, where were those investors? Were they all over the world or consolidated in the US or UK?
We're all over the world. We're all over the world. Yeah. Because the cool thing with CoinRule is that we are a layer on top of the exchanges, so we don't own the funds. You know, we ask you to connect your favorite platform through an API key to CoinRule. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, we are defined by the regulators as a software provider, because we don't touch our funds, and also we charge a flat monthly subscription. So it's like a SaaS platform, basically. So we don't charge on transaction, and we don't own your fund. So we are a software provider. So from day one, we were global, and there was a big market. And we always, me and Oleg, we always try, my co-founder, or we always try to create businesses that are very lean, and they can validate the market first before building the hardcore technology. So that's much more, it's a better way, it's more convenient, especially if you're starting with your own funds.
So understanding this growth hack, so conceptually what you're doing is you're creating an algorithm that you built that creates new landing pages systematically. So it says like run the script, create 10,000 new landing pages, use these keywords in different combinations. The content for the pages must be largely repetitive though, right? Otherwise, where would you be getting the content?
Yeah, I mean, no, but you can build it in a way that is not repetitive. So, you know, you have like variables in text. So you need to just do the main matrix, but it takes like, you take one freelancer, you know, in one language, it takes one day for him to do that matrix. And then the script mix and match that.
I'm surprised there's not, did you look at what's out there? Is there anything out there that does this?
No, basically, there's like, I know that some companies like big companies like Expedia, TripAdvisor, they do that. You know, they have a huge SEO team and they have proper CRM in place, and that's fine. But there is not such a tool on the market. So I know that maybe someday, you know, I could just give this one to someone to actually build this, spin it off as a different startup. And it's a good marketing tool. You know, it's not going to be a billion company, but it's a good marketing tool.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think the important, is it, how important is it that it is on the same domain? So as opposed to if you had like
very important. Yeah. There are like a lot of things that then you learn, you know, now we have like two SEO consultants and, you know, we kind of, I always speak to SEO people because I like SEO. But there are several technicalities that you need to look. So one of the main one is like, you cannot have, you know, 150,000 pages going through the same second level path of the URL. So there's coin.com/something, right? /exchange/strategy. They need to, you know, we have at least like 10, 20 different second level URL path to get through those pages. Yeah, that's very important.
Had you heard about that from someone else or has that been?
So there was, that's the thing. Like we were, the first fundraise before the crowdfunding was in Budapest, in Hungary. So let's go back like two steps. So the first fundraise was $200,000. It was given by a bank, MKB Bank from Budapest, Hungary, and from two angels that they happened to be my previous bosses when I was working in Finland 10 years earlier, my first job ever in Finland, working in their agency, working with Nokia, you know, the phone company back then, Nokia. Anyway, so we moved to Budapest for 4 months, and with another startup. It was a big house, you know, two startups with two dogs as well. They brought the dogs over. It was crazy. It was a lot. It was like an Erasmus project, you know, exchange university program, basically, almost. And then this guy was, Daniel is like, we became very good friends. He just like told me about this like, idea, just like mentioned, and really resonated with me. I just went nuts on that.
That's interesting. Yeah. And how did he dive deep and show you how it worked, or just the concept, just explaining it to you in the first place?
He did it in a very kind of light touch way with this company. And, you know, but they didn't really go obsessed on it. I really became obsessed.
Yeah. I mean, it's awesome. Do you think, is this something that every startup should do? I mean, I can't, if you're relying on growth, I mean, who shouldn't do this?
Who doesn't want
to? Yeah.
I mean, there's this, the book, you know, what's called Traction, right? It's a very good book for growth hacking. And it shows you 52 marketing channels and sales channels. And they tell you, you know, when you find something that works, just focus on that. So if you find one channel, just allocate all the funds there and just, you know, get obsessed with that. And then after you finish with them, with that works, then you can move to the next one and do some experiments. At the beginning, obviously, you take 3-5 channels, you do small experiments, and then you see what works. When you find something that works, just go for it. Mm. So for us, then, was difficult to move away from the organic acquisition strategy, because obviously the VCs, they want to see a proper paid customer acquisition cost. So we started experimenting with few channels, and then what worked was affiliate. So affiliate marketing now works very well. So we have an affiliate program. We talk to a lot of outlets. There's like enough. So it's very good relationship, but it's more qualitative. It's more intense in terms of relationship building. And then now we are experimenting again with the DSP, that is basically real-time bidding for banner spaces on different website networks. Because with crypto, few people that are not in crypto don't know that, but we cannot advertise on Facebook. We cannot advertise on Google. There are very strict regulations, and that's a really big limit in terms of customer acquisition. So you need to be very creative to actually, you know, work around those limits.
Have you heard anything about that changing? It seems like that would have to change. I mean, Facebook pivoted into crypto, effectively.
It's softened up a little bit, so there's something that you can do something. But there are also some strategies to kind of to use proxies to advertise that.
Mm. I assume the big tech companies are concerned about fraud primarily. There's people throwing.
Yes, it makes sense, because if you are a crypto exchange, by law you are required to have a license. So if you have a license, actually Google allow you to go to advertise, right? But in our case, the actual FCA in the UK told us that we are not a crypto business. We are a software provider. We have a paper from them, but then neither Google or Facebook, you know, want to look at this paper because it's all an automatic system. Mm. So yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. On the affiliates, those are like YouTubers and bloggers and these kind of things.
We have a group of traders, and then they have their own communities on everywhere: Discord, YouTube, Reddit. They are like also you know, magazine outlets that kind of do the distribution from you. It's a mix of things, but. Yeah, they're like you can join one of the big network like CJ, and you know, you put your program there, and then kind of marketers come to you, or you can just have your own program. Now, we have our own program, so it's very good. If any marketer you know listening wants to join, just reach out to me, and it's very good.
And did you do outreach for the affiliate program to set that up initially?
Yeah, we have a team for
okay.
that.
No, nice. Interesting. Yeah, I hope I hope they're not regulations. I hope the policies change for the companies to allow crypto more advertising dollars, because it's like there's got to be enormous pressure. You know, you want that as a crypto founder, people would want that as people interested in crypto products, and then obviously more ad money coming in for big tech companies is always a good thing. So,
and I mean, you know, there is, I don't understand, but there's like some app that can advertise, you know, even for betting or other activities and not crypto.
Yeah. curious to ask you about the YC experience being remote, right? It was remote when you were 2021.
Unfortunately, yes, it was remote.
Yeah. How was that? How did you see that as being different from in person in terms of the actual pragmatic experience of it? Obviously, you aren't physically near each other. Was there a pro to it, something that you got out of it more so than people in person wouldn't have got out of it? And then obviously the con being you don't get to break bread in person.
Yeah, I think I would have loved to go there because I'm a digital nomad since 5 years. I travel around and I've been in SF many times and, you know, in the various startup communities, so in co-living spaces as well. So, you know, being there would have been just like amazing, but knowing myself, it would have been also very distracting. So being at home, actually, you know, we lost a little bit on the social side, so we didn't build, you know, lifelong friends, but we were at home actually working much more because of the lockdowns and all of that. So overall, it was an amazing experience. I mean, they reached out when we were at something like 150K MRR, so it was already, you know, good revenues. So it was a big decision for us, like, should we join, should we not? Maybe we are too advanced for them. Also, I didn't really want to move to the US and the company had to move to Delaware because, you know, the UK and in, you know, Europe, and, yeah, they're giving us so much, like so much support, help, you know, free office space forever, like mentorship, advisory, and everything's, you know, building a startup in London is actually the best thing that can happen to you, like if you want to be an entrepreneur, because the legislation is so easy. There are all tools. Everything's very pragmatic. It's very actual. It's a very good ecosystem. So anyway, the concept of moving didn't resonate with me. But then we decided to go for it. It took 3 months to do all the paperwork just to flip the company. We spent like around $50,000 just to move all the company there. But then overall, it was a good choice because, you know, we got mentored by the founders of Airbnb, and Brancesc is one of my role model because he comes also from a design background. So, you know, I really see a team like, okay, this can be done. There's the guy from Stripe. We got mentored by Tom from Monzo. You know, and our group partners were just great. And your experience just end up like kind of playing in a different league. Like, you know, you become like part of the Silicon Valley mafia, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
They're on their own information and their own intranet called Bookface that's super private, but super full of information. You can reach out to any founders or previous company, current company. They will reply to you. They will help you out. It's just great. We also have one of the some reviews of a few VCs, you know, how they behave with our colleagues. So whenever they contact us, we go there and we check, you know, is this guy good? You know, he just went away from the deal like the day before. And then there is this very interesting thing that happened when you VC. So you join, and then, you know, you're just like startup, and then you start having a lot of kind of outreach from people that you don't know and they want to invest in you. And these people are kind of, when you join, you're not yet public, right? No one is at your NYC. So they start asking you questions to understand if you're part of the program. And then, like, you know, because obviously they want to start talking to you early on so they can have a better deal. But that's what they tell NYC, don't talk to investors, you know, at the beginning for the first couple of months. And then you do the demo day. It's amazing. You know, it's like you pitch for 1 minute, and we got like more than hundreds emails of people interested in investing, funds, like even Binance as well, wanted to to invest a ticket, but we preferred not to take it at this stage, maybe in the future, totally. So that was a very strange situation. We did a 2.2 million round, so relatively small. We could have done easily like 10 million, but we didn't want to dilute too much because already we were having good, we were already at some point for 6 months, we were already cash flow positive. So we had money in the bank. And then after that, you just are on the radar of all the big VCs. Now we talk with, Andreessen Horowitz, Axel, Atomic, all the big VCs. And it's very interesting. And then it's funny, like, you know, we entered a specific valuation that we were already negotiating with one VC in Switzerland, even before YC. After 3 months, our valuation just doubled. For no reason, really, for no reason. Like, I don't know why. The same company, the revenue, okay, you know, they were growing. That's fine, but you know, it's like it's really a really big leverage, a big like stamp, validation stamp, and also like just the family is just great. All the people in YC, all the founders are just amazing people.
Yeah, that's a really cool story. So internally, the resources that are there, obviously the people, huge part of it. There's a the investor review list, they have a similar thing in Techstars too, another accelerator, basically reviewing investors. Because from the founder's perspective, this is happening on the other side of the table. Investors are getting together and they're using their compound effects to pressure you down on valuations. And they do deals all day, every day. So they're much more familiar with the terms and negotiating tactics. So I view this as something that founders have collectively against to push back on investors. Is that, you said Bookface, is that the name of the resource or the CRM that lists this?
I think maybe, I don't know if I'm allowed to say.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
probably.
That's a great name. I don't know. I don't know if it's a top secret or not. I do find, tell me if this is your experience too, that there's a shift psychologically when you talk to Brian from Airbnb. I don't know about your conversation with him, but oftentimes I find when you talk to people who have started big companies, you're not getting any deep insight about the specific tactics of growing your business. That's like, oh my God, that was such a good idea that, we never would have thought about it, because you're a smart guy and you think about this all the time. And it's much more about like, hey, you can do it attitude. The world is 8 billion people in it, and it's super competitive and everyone's building super fast in crypto. It's like, it can often feel as a founder, especially when you're working alone and you have a distributed team, it can feel like, how are we going to overcome or make this happen and turn this into a billion-dollar company? And when you speak to people who have done it before, it reiterates the pathway. It's like, oh, you do A, and then you do B, and then you do C, and then you do D. You don't jump from A to D. And that motivation is not trivial. It's a really influential part of why people are successful, is that they deeply internalize the emotional experience of being successful. Is that something that resonates with you? Have you felt that way? Or
part of that is because, let's be honest, I mean, the most successful company in the world are Americans, right? And, founders are Americans. So it must be also a cultural element. But if you take us as European or European founder, it's totally different. Like me, I'm an open book to everyone, right? And I talk about all the bad stuff that happened in the company, because I strongly believe this is much more constructive and, than actually just saying like, everything is good, I'm amazing, and showing off your Lamborghini car. So in fact, what I do, I actually go and talk a lot to founders that that actually failed, because you can learn much more from them. They can tell you what went wrong. And whenever I do a business, when I found that someone did the same business 3 years before me, I just go there and contact them. And they were they always tell me what do you want from me? But they have that, they've gone through all of that. They've analyzed the problem. They've validated or unvalidated the problem. They felt the pain and they've done already that journey. So I can just go there, either literally pay them to give me all that knowledge so that I don't do the same journey. And then sometimes you can take it, you can see that, there was a problem in execution, or maybe the market was not yet ready for that product, but at least you get a big insight. So what not to do if you want to go in that field. And that's, I think, that should be the attitude. Just laugh and smile about all the fuck up that happened in the company, in the startup, because that's what really makes you learn. Obviously, my experience when I meet this, we had basically every day we were doing with the Y Combinator, we had 3 hours workshop every day. It was like going back to uni. But then when we met this big founder, very successful founder, very smart people, then you see that, they're like, they don't know. They don't know, sometimes they don't know what's the best thing. It worked for them, but it doesn't mean that it will work for you. In fact, they talk about their experience. Usually they say what worked for me was blah, 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 blah. So it's really a startup is kind of, it's magic happening, magic it happened on the fly, and you need to kind of make sense of it. And that magic happens because of a contextual situation that it was in a specific region, the specific time, that specific market, right? Obviously, there are techniques that you can take, but then you always need to kind of bring those techniques down to your situations. And maybe one thing that's shared across founders is maybe the positive approach, the problem-solving approach, also being very drastic in your decision, because even when you do experiments, right, you want to change the price, right? You cannot change just a little bit incremental change. You need to go do drastic experiments to understand if actually A or B works. Otherwise, you don't have clarity on your data set. So, for example, we are doing experiment with pricing now. We're going to go let's switch from monthly to quarterly. you know, 10% of the users and let's see what happens. That's it. So, you know, like also an experiment. So this is probably one of the characteristics that I've seen in a lot of founders. So being calm, kind of crunching through, but also being able to cut through the crap when it's needed.
Yeah. Yeah. Good perspectives. You mentioned the regulation in London. Is it the regulation in the UK? And how do you feel about the UK, certainly as unbiased as possible? How do you feel about the trajectory of the startup ecosystem in the UK? Certainly the advantage of the American market is that there's just more humans in America than there is in the UK. Are there other factors that you think either limit or help accelerate growth in cities like London?
I think London is, if you take maybe one borough of London, it's probably as big as the 7 Mile of San Francisco. So, and if you go in the right mind, right borough, like Hackney or Hoxton, with a lot of hipsters, you can really have a controlled experiment of your MVP. So that's a very good thing. On top of that, the government has a lot of incentives for investors, where they actually, it's a kind of a scheme called SEIS, where 50% of the money you invest in a company actually goes back to you as a credit in tax. And that's really for the pre-seed investment, like the first 150K, 200K, it's really the hack. That's very good. And then secondly, they strongly believe in entrepreneurship here. So there's a lot of support at when you're starting, when you really need it. Because the, I mean, from zero to one, the famous zero to one, that's where you need the most support. Right. And here you can find, like, even, you know, if you think about legal advice, here it's much cheaper than the US. So in the US, man, after we flipped the company to Delaware, my lawyer charged me under $50 for introduction to a bank. An introduction that he asked me to do. Like, do you want an introduction to a bank? Because I was like, oh, yes, sure. Introduce me. Next thing I know, the invoice is like under $50 for the introduction. I was like, what? So now we have this this deal that you're always going to write on off meter on the subject of the email. Because, like, you know, this will never happen in the UK because they understand you're starting off and the startup and all of that. So there are like a lot of benefits. But then there is the main problem is on the go-to-market. Because, you know, as you were mentioning, 400 million people in the US, you do one product, you know, and you launch it. That's it. You know, the states are different, but more or less the same language, same kind of behavior, more or less. In Europe, each single country has got a different language, different behaviors, different regulations. So it's kind of, it's much more difficult in terms of scaling up a business. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that. So you, I think, grew up in Naples, Italy. And
yeah, Naples.
My ancestors, 25% of them, come from Italy. My great-grandfather came over on a boat, or a train and boat, and, you know, Ellis Island, New York, did that whole thing. And it worked out. You know, I'm here and alive. How do you, what's your perspective on Italy's trajectory? I don't see a lot of startups coming out of Italy. Is the language barrier, culture, some other element? I mean, why are you not in Italy? And what do you think about Italy's technologies?
I'm not sure the best. I'm totally detached from that. I mean, obviously, I go and visit my family. I love to go there on holiday. But I can see from us. I literally never worked in Italy, maybe only for 6 months when I was at uni. But then my first job was in Finland and then London and then US and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't even know what's the work culture, but from what I can see, it's really based around kind of families and strong relationship at work. So your colleagues become your friends. And then it's just, I'm not sure. It's all about probably taking risks. And also there's this thing that probably they say the same also about California, that, you know, you have a very good weather and very good, like, food and very good, you know, beautiful country. You know, you don't have that drive to actually go back on the laptop and just work all day. If you go to Finland, they work so much in Finland because they have nothing to do. It's cold outside. So it's a mix of cultural. Italy is like, I think it's not great at tech, but it's great at luxury goods. Because they really, in terms of luxury goods and fashion and design, you know, they're the best. So they actually have brands like Ferrari, like they have brands like, you know, Lamborghini. All of that is good because it's kind of culturally, you know, we have all that aesthetic and art history background and we can easily do that. But in terms of taking risk, building the latest tech, proprietary tech, it's good for research. It's very theoretical, but it's not great for like the actual applied technology, kind of the merging the commercial side of it with the university side of it or the research side of it. So that's why, you know, like a lot of people just go, when you want to build a company and you are in Italy, you try to make it kind of in Milan, because Milan is more kind of international and it's a great city. I love it. Or you just go to London. A few people go to maybe Berlin, but yeah. So I think that also the language, like in essence, the English language is a very pragmatic type of way of communicating. It's really, it's much more dynamic and it fits very well with doing business. So when I try to speak in Italian with my Italian friends about business, I don't have half of the vocabulary.
Oh, interesting.
It's just a different culture and different way of working. And then when I hear someone speaking Italian about business, it sounds so weird to me. So yeah, so it's I think it's just a different culture, and maybe at some point they will become also a bit better in that.
Yeah, interesting. I like thinking about it. For me, I guess perspective being in America, the market here is so large that you often interview people and they're in their Series C, Series D, they may even IPO and never leave the country. And that's just a pure fact about how big the market is. Whereas in Europe, like you said, it's more eclectic or varied across languages. There does seem to be the common element of the EU, which, you know, London and UK are no longer a part of. That is done, right? Yeah. I think as of, yeah.
Technically it's done, but culturally it's not. I mean,
yeah,
you can assume, like, you know, everyone is European here. And,
yeah.
It was just, I don't know, it was a glitch. I once said to a journalist that I think Brexit will be reverted, and everyone is holding me accountable to that.
How? Really? I'm surprised. I almost think that, if you look at the voting demographic, the younger people voted to stay. Largely, and the older people mm-hmm. voted to leave. So certainly, yeah. You know, time is on your side. And once you do a revote, I would imagine people
won't give up. Yeah, they do it. You know, in any other normal democracy with the kind of president of a republic and stuff like that, after Brexit, I mean, after the referendum, they would have actually stepped back and actually do more kind of, parliamentary consultation to understand if that would have been a right choice. But here they just went through because, as I said, they were very pragmatic.
Yeah. How about you personally? So I know you love reading and learning a lot of different things. Are you currently actively reading, learning new skills, anything particularly top of mind?
Okay, now I'm learning French. So yeah, okay. My Monday and Wednesday I'll talk about French. So trying to listen to French music, French movies. So, and then, I'm also looking to buy a house. So every if I'm not like learning French, I'm basically going around to view apartments. That's what I'm doing nowadays. But in terms of reading, I'm reading the big classic, Hackers and Painters from Paul Graham.
Mm-hmm.
That I started and then I stopped and I picked up again on my Kindle. And then I'm reading a lot of kind of French books for kids because it's more easy to understand. So
I like it. How is Hackers and Painters? I've never read it, but I've heard about it.
It's it kind of talks about like, it's not just like tech, it actually talks about like how really smart teenagers end up being the nerd and they're like not really part of a group. So they actually diverge and they actually start thinking toward and looking at things in different ways. And that's how probably they become startup material. So it's very interesting because it's like the genesis of the beginning of an entrepreneur. They don't just talk about being a company, but how your education and being in a specific hood and, you know, following specific people, they don't follow the mass. Actually, it's very beneficial for startup. So, you know, basically when you're at in high school and you're not the cool kid, you're probably, considered like a loser. But in that case, you have more time actually to experiment, being at home and reading and actually experiment things on the tech side more than just going partying, you know, being the cool guy. So it actually gives you a really different perspective how the nerd became to be the cool people in Silicon Valley.
Mm. Interesting. Any thoughts? I know you're an ideas guy. Do you have across the pathway of building CoinRule, are there other business concepts that you've stumbled across that you're like, oh man, if I wasn't building CoinRule, this would be something? You obviously mentioned the landing page idea. Are there other products that you wish existed either in crypto or elsewhere?
I dream of a lot of products, but then they don't exist. Actually, before CoinRule, I play a lot of tennis. So I really wanted to have this basically something for quickly booking like a court and a tennis match. And then I put together 2-3 people. And then I was like, guys, I'll put you together because I'm excited about this, but actually I'm full-time on court. I don't have time. And then that stuff died. And then after 1 year, this guy comes to me like, man, I got investment. I'm doing this app. Remember that app? And then actually it's happening. So it's cool. I'm using this app called RacketPal. And it's in London, so I can just find people to play with, and it's amazing. And that was one thing. And then there are always like a lot of ideas, but I try to kind of keep it focused on this one. Like, I know that after CoinRule, probably I'll do something about climate tech, because I'm an environmentalist, I'm vegetarian, you know, by choice, because I want to offset my flights. I try to take the train when I can. Like, now I have this rule that flights before 2 hours are banned. I just take a train. For example, last time I did Paris to Naples. It was amazing. It was like Paris Milan, 7 hours. I was working like easily, like, and you pass by the countryside, Chamonix with snow, and then Milan Naples was 4 hours. So relaxing. You can work. You know, you feel good because of the environment. So yeah, I think climate tech would be one of the things I would like to tackle next.
That's interesting. I like that. Yeah, that'll be a big one too. So where can people reach you? Are you active on Twitter? Are you writing on the internet?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. Reach me basically mostly on LinkedIn. Nowadays at LinkedIn because I have all my investors there, so I need to communicate to them. Or just send an email, gab@coinrule.com. So easily.
Yeah. And do you manage investor communication on Twitter, on LinkedIn? Or is it just company updates?
We have the official email, like, you know, the report every month, and we are very religious about that. But then I always publish 2-3 kind of news from my personal account, not even the company account. So yeah, I try to leverage that.
Sweet, man. Well, I enjoyed chatting with you. Congrats on all the progress. What would be helpful for CoinRule? Are you guys looking to, you raised money recently? Are you trying to hire people or new customers?
Yeah. Totally. So we are looking for a head of growth or like a marketing manager. You know, we don't mind the different, you know, the experience, like how much experience you have. We need someone talented. And then we are looking for a design lead, because I cannot do design at night anymore. Because I'm the only designer in the company still. When I do the business, I need to actually open Figma and start like designing UIs.
Damn. Good for you. You've done everything, all the design work so far?
No, not all design myself, but you know, kind of at least 60%.
Yeah. Well, it looks great. I really like the product. So check it out, coinrule.com. My man, Gabriel, thanks for coming on, and wish you the best, dude.
Perfect. Thank you very much, guys.
See you, buddy.
Thank you for listening to Around the Coin. If you enjoyed the show today, consider giving us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts, tweet about it, or text it to a friend. We really appreciate all the support and growing that we can. If you have any guests you'd like us to bring on or feedback for us, don't hesitate to reach out. We would love to hear from you.
This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.